Willkommen zu diesem 234. Europe Calling. Mein Name ist Maximilian Fries. Ich bin der Geschäftsführer von Europe Calling und darf wie immer heute Abend moderieren. Ganz besonders begrüße ich unsere heutigen Diskussionsgäste, Nathanael Leminski, Nina Jankovic und Alexandra Gese. Ich stelle ich gleich noch genauer vor, wenn sie dann dran sind. Bevor es losgeht, ein paar kurze Hausmitteilungen. Wir werden heute einen Mix aus Deutsch und Englisch sprechen. Solltet ihr dabei Unterstützung brauchen, haben wir eine wunderbare Crew von Dolmetscherinnen. Unter dem kleinen Globus in der Kontrollleiste könnt ihr dann einfach die Sprache auswählen. Vielen Dank an die Dolmetscherin. Wie immer bei Europe Calling könnt ihr eure Fragen stellen und die Fragen der anderen bewerten. Heute nutzen wir dazu Slido. Den Link dazu seht ihr gleich im Chat. Stellt deren gern eure Fragen und bewertet, ganz wichtig, auch die Fragen der anderen. Nur so können wir bei fast 3000 Anmeldungen die Fragen stellen, die euch auch wirklich interessieren. Ganz wichtig, bitte schreibt euren Namen dazu. Ist einfach viel schöner, als wenn ich mir die ganze Zeit etwas ausdenken muss oder anonyme Userin im Ernstfall sagen muss. Und der Link dazu, wie gesagt, kommt gleich in den Chat. Und wie immer wird Europe Calling aufgezeichnet und ist dann jetzt schon live auf YouTube und kommt danach als Podcast zum Hören beim Laufen oder Autofahren auch noch online. Bitte beachtet das, wenn ihr Fragen mit eurem Namen stellt. Das war es schon mit den Hausmitteilungen. Und ich will heute dieses Webinar mal mit einem Zitat beginnen und einleiten, und zwar ein Zitat von Emmanuel Macron, französischen Präsidenten. Der war nämlich vor 2 Wochen im britischen Unterhaus, im britischen Parlament, Unter- und Oberhaus, glaube ich. Und der hat etwas gesagt zu dem Thema heute, und das will ich euch hier einmal reingeben, bevor wir dann starten. Was er gesagt hat, ist: Was heute in Europa auf dem Spiel steht, ist die Verteidigung demokratischer Modelle inmitten ausländischer Einmischung, Informationsmanipulation und der Beherrschung der Köpfe durch negative Emotionen und die Sucht nach sozialen Medien. Er hat das natürlich auf Englisch und mit einem französischen Akzent und damit viel schöner gesagt, aber ich glaube, das nimmt uns hier sehr gut rein. Ich stelle das auch gleich nochmal in den Chat zum Nachlesen. Und mit diesem Einstieg übergebe ich an unseren ersten Gast, Nina Jankovic. Sie ist US-amerikanische Forscherin und Autorin. 2022 hat US-Präsident Biden damals sie zur Leiterin einer neuen Behörde gemacht, dem Disinformation Governance Board. Und genau, sie war da die erste Leiterin. Sie ist jetzt Begründerin, Mitbegründerin und Chefin des American Sunlight Project, einer gemeinnützigen Organisation, die sich gegen Desinformation einsetzt und heute hier dabei. Und wir freuen uns sehr auf deinen kleinen Input. Liebe Nina, bitte.
Thank you so much, everyone. It's really lovely to be with so many participants across Europe. I have spent a lot of time in Europe. I have researched your responses to countering disinformation, and it's just a delight to be with you today. So I've been asked to answer the question, what's the role of disinformation and propaganda, and how do they influence politics? What do they do to our democracy? And I thought I'd first start with defining disinformation because despite the fact that we are now more than 8 years into this disinformation crisis, when the West finally woke up to the threat of disinformation, there are still people who use these terms very inaccurately, or use them in ways that are, easily mixed with other terms that actually have different meanings. And when we're talking about information, it's important that we are precise because the purveyors of disinformation, the people who use it for power and for profit, play fast and loose with definitions and often are quite imprecise with how they address this topic. So disinformation is the use of false or misleading information with malign intent. They can be broader parts of influence operations run by foreign governments, but they can also exist in the domestic context, right? And I think the most important thing to understand about disinformation and broadly about influence operations is that without a shared reality, without shared facts, our democracy can't function. When you have people going to the ballot box, who are voting on a reality that does not exist, then we end up in polarized situations like what my own country is experiencing now, in the second Trump administration, where folks are just diametrically opposed to one another, not agreeing on very much, can't even agree on the basic facts of the threats to our country right now. It's a very, very serious situation. Now, I would be remiss to say that disinformation is something that is, let me rephrase that, that disinformation is the cause of all of these problems, or that we're all of this is coming from foreign manipulation. It's not. The most successful disinformation that I've found in my career, and you can see my book is right here, How to Lose the Information War, looks at six different countries in Central and Eastern Europe and the way that they responded to disinformation before the West even recognized it was a threat. One of the most important things I learned when researching that book was that the most potent disinformation, the most successful disinformation, has a kernel of truth to it. It is not fully whole cloth fabricated falsehoods. It is often stuff that plays on people's real grievances and worries about society. So if you look at the types of things that we saw coming out of the Russian Internet Research Agency back in 2016, many of them will seem familiar today because they're still the hot button issues that our societies are grappling with. Things like immigration, things like in the United States, gun rights. These are issues that we tend to find a lot of passion about. And when there is passion, when there is emotion, then the facts can get very easily twisted. The Russians continue to use, foreign information manipulation and interference, FIMI, or just influence operations, if you'd like to say it more simply. They continue to do this, but they are evolving their tactics. Now, first, one of the most important things that has changed since 2016, of course, is the way that social media platforms have morphed over the 8 years. I would say around 2020 was the peak of social media platforms responding to harmful content online, whether that was disinformation, hate speech, or otherwise. And we've really fallen off a cliff since then. As you are likely aware, the social media platforms are now all but in bed with President Trump, sitting in the front row behind him during his inauguration, in front of even members of the Trump cabinet. They have really changed their policies on trust and safety and content moderation to be more loose when it comes to disinformation and other harmful content. And that means that we're seeing a lot less action taken across the board toward domestic information, certainly, but also toward foreign disinformation. And that opens up a lot of possibilities for our foreign adversaries, not just Russia, but China, Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, et cetera. Russia continues to be, I think, ahead of the curve when it comes to disinformation, iterating on a lot of openings in society that may not have existed before. And one of the ways that they're doing that is by using artificial intelligence, which everyone loves to talk about. So I'd be remiss not to mention it today. My organization, the American Sunlight Project, did a little bit of digging into a network called Pravda, which was first attributed by the French agency Viginum last fall, I believe, as a Russian operation. And one of my researchers was looking at Pravda, which is this collection of content aggregation websites that takes Russian propaganda and reposts it on a bunch of identical websites across the web in different languages. And she was thinking to herself, why is it that this network is so poor? They're really bad at what they do. These websites are not easily used by humans. They don't have working search bars. The scroll is broken. They look like they're from 1999. They don't have a big social media presence. What could be going on here? And what she ended up doing was calculating the amount of content that these networks were pushing out in 1 year. And by our estimate, it's over 3.6 million pieces of content per year that Pravda is pushing out on these low-quality websites. And her hypothesis, which has now since been confirmed, is that the Pravda network is pushing out all of this content in order to groom large language models like ChatGPT into spitting out Russian propaganda. They are flooding the zone with a bunch of bad content that is, hateful and misleading on the one hand, and just completely fabricated on the other hand. A lot of it is about Ukraine. And so we found recently that even when you ask ChatGPT's sophisticated reasoning models, the ones that you have to pay more money for in order to answer questions about Ukraine, they're still citing Pravda, even though these reasoning models know that Pravda is a Russian propaganda network. So that's one way our foreign friends are attempting to influence us with AI. The other way that I think is important to point out is back in the early days of online influence operations coming from Russia, we used to be able to pick them up from interesting linguistic cues, right? Especially in English, you know, they would drop articles, idioms would be used incorrectly. You could tell Google Translate was being used. With large language models, you can create pitch perfect, idiomatically and grammatically correct content that is, you know, tailored to the most vulnerable and specific audiences in the click of a button, right? It is much easier to create that stuff, and you can create compelling visual content to go along with it. It used to take quite an army of people to do that, and now all you need is a subscription to a large language model. So that's the current situation with foreign interference. Of course, you know, I think as an American right now, foreign interference is not my main concern because disinformation has become the policy of this current administration in the United States. They are, as you all know, bullying the European Union into watering down or not enforcing the Digital Services Act, among other legislation that would curb disinformation, threatening the EU with tariffs over it, you know, making and implementing its own laws. And that sort of behavior is what led me to, when I was in European Parliament in April, to call the United States an autocracy. Any of the behaviors that we're seeing coming from this administration, from, you know, arresting people for writing op-eds, those who are legally in the country, students usually, to bullying sovereign nations and to not enforcing their own laws against American companies. I mean, in a horse by any other name would be called an autocratic horse, right? So that's where we are. I think it is important to recognize now that Russia, China, Iran are getting a lot of help from the Trump administration, which again, is very regularly bending the truth to put it diplomatically and outright lying to put it undiplomatically. The other thing that I will point out is that the Trump administration has dismantled the US response to counter disinformation, both through the effort that I was involved in, that Maximilian mentioned in my introduction, which was widely lied about. And as a result, I received a lot of threats, harassment. Still to this day, I get threats and harassment because of the lies that were told about me and my work in the Biden administration. And that was in 2022, before this administration was even in office. Now we've seen the dominoes fall one by one. The Global Engagement Center at the State Department, which attributed so many of the foreign influence operations that we've heard about over the past few years, it's gone. Its employees have been fired summarily by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who has lied and said that those folks who were dedicated civil servants, subject matter experts, were censoring people. It's just totally untrue. Other entities, including the FBI's Foreign Influence Task Force, have been disbanded. We've seen similar things happen across the federal government, and organizations like mine and other organizations in the United States that focused on countering disinformation and bringing these threats to the public are under legal threat. We are having a hard time getting funding because so many of the philanthropies and our donors are now scared to associate with folks who are doing work in this space. So I think the impact, to bring it back to the opening question, the impact of disinformation on democracy is that it leaves us confused about what is true and what is not. It puts researchers, truth tellers, journalists under threat because they are characterized in ways that are not true. And it leaves our institutions open to interference from foreign entities, often helped by some governments that might be, you know, welcoming to this, whether they recognize that they're doing that overtly or not. But I don't want to leave you on too pessimistic of a note. As I wrap up, I've always been an optimist in this space. If you ever see me totally opt out of, you know, engaging in the counter disinformation space, you will know I've lost my optimism. But as it stands, I still get up every day and I do this work because I've seen, no matter where I travel, small towns in Europe to small towns here in the United States, in the Midwest, in the West, I've connected with audiences all around the world who may not be experts on this topic, but they want to be empowered to navigate this very confusing information environment in a way that serves them, right? They don't necessarily know all the ins and outs of how algorithms work or how the media environment works in the social media age, but we can teach them. And one of the most inspiring things that I saw in my research in Central and Eastern Europe back before the pandemic was that even smaller, less affluent countries were investing in teaching people how to navigate today's information environment. And that doesn't mean saying this media outlet is good, this media outlet is bad. It means telling them about how advertising online works. It means telling them about the signs they can look for related to emotional manipulation. If you're feeling emotional when you're reading a piece of content, there's a good chance you're being manipulated. That one heuristic really helps people navigate. And one other final thing that I do, and I do this with my graduate students at Syracuse University as well. These are all folks going into careers in public policy. They're all highly professional people from, around 25 to 40 years old. And still, when I have them track their information consumption over a 24-hour period, they are shocked at the degree to which their information consumption is passive. We all need to get a lot more deliberate about our information consumption, recognizing that if you're getting something from a push alert or a notification, it's being driven to you for a reason, and that might be making the tech companies more money, right? So how can we return that deliberation to our information consumption, both in what we are consuming and what we're sharing as well? We all need to take care before we share. And you all, this wonderful audience, are taking a great first step by being at an educational webinar like this, by interacting with me and my very distinguished co-speakers, and I'm thrilled to be here today. So looking forward to your questions, and thanks again for having me.
Nina, ganz herzlichen Dank dafür. Das war richtig klasse. Ganz viele Themen, die wir jetzt dann gleich noch aufbringen. Ich will, bevor ich an den nächsten Speaker übergebe, kurz noch einen kleinen Technikhinweis machen. Alle, die Deutsch und Englisch einfach hören und die Dolmetschung gar nicht brauchen, jetzt, die können gerne auf den Link, den ich jetzt nochmal poste, auf YouTube gehen. Da läuft genau dasselbe, nur ohne Dolmetschung in der Originalsprache, damit wir hier vielleicht ein bisschen mehr Raum haben für alle die, die doch eine Dolmetschung brauchen. Der ist hier einfach begrenzt auf Zoom, aber in YouTube ist es unendlich. Das heißt, alle, die Originalsprachen verstehen, Deutsch und Englisch und sowieso keine Dolmetschung brauchen, weil sie den ganzen Tag Netflix auf Englisch hören, zum Beispiel, die gerne direkt auf YouTube. So, das der kleine Technikhinweis, und ich sehe schon an den Zahlen, ihr kennt das alle und macht das sehr, sehr gut. Und dann darf ich jetzt unseren zweiten Gast begrüßen, Nathanael Leminski. Er ist Minister für Bundes- und Europaangelegenheiten, Internationales sowie Medien des Landes Nordrhein-Westfalen und Chef der Staatskanzlei. Er ist CDU-Mitglied, sogar Vorsitzender CDU-Bezirksverband Mittelrhein, war lange aktiv, auch in der letzten Landesregierung. Und für alle, die es nicht wissen, in Nordrhein-Westfalen, hier in dem größten Bundesland in Deutschland, gibt es eine schwarz-grüne Landesregierung, also aus CDU und Grüne. Also ist ein bisschen hier heute auch abgebildet auf diesem Panel. Und lieber Herr Leminski, ich freue mich sehr, dass Sie da sind und jetzt auf Ihre Eingangsworte und dann später auf die Diskussion. Bitte schön.
Ja, danke, lieber Herr Fries, liebe Frau Jankovic, liebe Frau Gese, liebe Gäste hier im Chat. Ich freue mich sehr, dabei zu sein und bin erst einmal wirklich beeindruckt, wie viele Menschen Sie zusammenbringen. Das ist im besten Sinne das, was wir uns als Europapolitiker wünschen, nämlich eine europäische Öffentlichkeit. Etwas, was ja immer wieder in der Diskussion ist und wonach wir uns sehen, was wir auch brauchen als legitimatorische Grundlage dafür, die europäische Ebene zu stärken. Und diese europäische Öffentlichkeit, die ist generell wichtig, aber die ist natürlich nochmal besonders wichtig bei dem Thema, über das wir heute Abend hier sprechen, nämlich den Angriff auf unsere Öffentlichkeit und damit auch auf unsere wehrhafte Demokratie durch Desinformation. Und deswegen danke für den Insiderblick aus den USA, liebe Frau Jankovic und Frau Gese, wir haben uns ja schon häufiger ausgetauscht, und von Ihnen stammte ja auch die Idee, dass ich mal hier dazukomme. Freue ich mich sehr drüber und bin auch gespannt auf Ihre Ausführungen dann später. Wir haben es gerade gehört, Desinformation ist eine Gefahr von innen und von außen. Und was wir erleben, sind ja tiefgreifende Auswirkungen. Wir erleben zum einen wie gezielt über Kampagnen aus dem Ausland Einfluss genommen werden soll auf Wahlen. Haben wir auch bei uns hier in Deutschland zuletzt gehabt, mit Blick auf unsere Bundestagswahl. Wir erleben aber zum anderen auch, wie durch Verleumdung gezielt Vertrauen in journalistische Angebote erschüttert werden soll. Wir erleben zum Dritten, wie sich Plattformen verweigern, Verantwortung zu übernehmen für das, was auf ihren Angeboten passiert. Und damit erleben wir alles in allem, wie unser demokratisches Verständnis von Freiheit und auch ihren Grenzen nicht nur in Frage gestellt wird, sondern tatsächlich auch hart angegriffen wird. Und das wird häufig festgemacht am Unterschied der Diskussion darüber zwischen Europa und den USA. Und ich glaube, wenn man das diskutieren will und betrachten will, dann lohnt es sich, auch einmal einen Blick darauf zu werfen, welch unterschiedliches Verständnis wir haben, zum einen von Freiheit generell, Redefreiheit im Besonderen, und zum anderen aber auch vom Verhältnis zwischen Bürger und Staat. Jetzt hab ich nun selber das Glück gehabt, zum einen in den USA zur Schule zu gehen, eine Zeit lang, zum anderen aber auch im Rahmen meiner Ausbildung dort länger zu sein, nach wie vor viele Freunde dort zu haben und verfolge deswegen das Geschehen. Und wenn man sich da im politischen Raum bewegt, dann stellt man schnell fest, in den USA wird sehr viel Wert darauf gelegt, von einem großen Teil der Gesellschaft mindestens, dass der Staat sich möglichst wenig einmischt. Und auch das Verständnis von Freiheit ist, gerade von Redefreiheit, ein sehr, sehr weitgehendes. Und dass dieses, man könnte sagen, libertäre Verständnis von Redefreiheit, das hat ja momentan Konjunktur, ein bisschen in die Administration. Und hat aber gleichzeitig eben auch Konjunktur geschaffen für solche Vorwürfe wie Zensur oder Lügenverbot hier in Europa und in Deutschland. Dinge, die uns dann hier begegnen. In Europa haben wir dagegen eine Tradition, dass der Staat eher schützt. Und Freiheit bedeutet hier immer auch die Rechte des anderen, der anderen zu achten und zu schützen. Und insofern eine, wie ich finde, deutlich engere Verbindung von Freiheit und Verantwortung. Und ich glaube, dass dieses unterschiedliche Verständnis von Freiheit in der Diskussion über Desinformation, in der Diskussion über die Regulierung von Plattformen nun sich zuspitzt und wirklich einen Gegensatz darstellt. Und wir müssen das einfach mal festhalten, weil für alle überzeugten Transatlantiker, wie ich es auch einer bin, ist das ein harter Tropf, den zu lutschen. Erst einmal zu verstehen, dass wir an der Stelle, an einem Punkt, wo es auch durchaus um Werte geht, leider einen echten Gegensatz feststellen können und feststellen müssen vielmehr. Und wenn es jetzt nun darum geht, was ist die richtige Antwort darauf in Deutschland und Europa vor allen Dingen, dann müssen wir erst einmal uns fragen, sozusagen, welche Inhalte tatsächlich gegen geltende Gesetze, gegen geltendes Recht verstoßen. Aber welche Inhalte auch gleichzeitig erst einmal zulässig sind, selbst wenn sie uns nicht gefallen. Und das ist deshalb wichtig, weil bei uns in Europa die Rechtstradition der Meinungsfreiheit auch einen sehr weiten Raum durchaus einräumt und dabei wir Dinge aushalten müssen, moralisch, politisch, in vielerlei Hinsicht, die nicht immer schön sind, die man nicht immer teilt. Und jede Form von Regulierung, die an der Stelle geschaffen wird, muss umso klarer, konziser und konkreter sein. Gerade auch, weil wir nicht zuletzt aufgrund der Digitalisierung in einer Zeit leben, wo die Menschen vielleicht noch sensibler sind als zu anderen Zeiten, inwieweit hier Regeln erlassen werden für Öffentlichkeit oder nicht. Und jede Regulierung, die an der Stelle geschaffen wird, muss daher auch im Stresstest bestehen und muss sich auch gegenüber sozusagen auch den Fragen derer, die vielleicht Verschwörungstheorien anhängen, bewähren. Und deswegen ist es wichtig, ihm dabei ein paar Regeln zu beachten. Und ein paar Sachen dazu will ich hier als Impuls gerne hier mit reingeben. Zum einen müssen wir erst einmal klar machen, im Netz gilt das gleiche Recht wie offline. Was heißt das konkret? Wir haben uns über Jahrzehnte politisch, gesellschaftlich, rechtlich, auch in Form der Rechtsprechung, Regeln entwickelt in unserer demokratischen Gesellschaft, die nun in die digitale Welt übersetzt werden. Was meine ich damit? Ich meine damit zum Beispiel, dass wer den Holocaust leugnet, wer falsche Tatsachen über andere verbreitet, wer Gewalt androht, der kann sich nicht auf auf sein Grundrecht auf freie Meinungsäußerung berufen, sondern der verstößt gegen Strafrecht. Und das ist einfach etwas, wo, wenn man das mal so festhält, wir im Austausch etwa mit US-amerikanischen Vertretern feststellen, dass das für die ein deutlich zu enges Verständnis von Freiheit ist. Da würde vieles noch unter das First Amendment reichen, der freien Meinungsäußerung, wo wir hier sagen würden, es ist geltendes Recht. Und wenn das auf der Straße gilt, dann muss das auch im Netz gelten. Umgekehrt, ich habe es gerade eben gesagt, sind viele der Inhalte, die auch über Desinformationskampagnen verbreitet werden, als Inhalte erst einmal zulässig. Auch eben Dinge, die wir nur schwer aushalten können. Und die Diskussion darüber, die sollten wir auch kontrovers führen. Aber was wir nicht dulden müssen und aus meiner Sicht auch nicht dulden dürfen, ist, wenn Öffentlichkeit manipuliert wird. Und da ist der Punkt, und auch Fakten manipuliert werden. Und da ist der Punkt, wo aus meiner Sicht auch der Staat gefragt ist. Und das ist natürlich ganz klar der Fall in dem Moment, wo Desinformationskampagnen ansetzen. Ich denke etwa an den massenhaften Einsatz von Fake-Accounts, an den massenhaften Einsatz von Bots, an den massenhaften Einsatz von gezielter Reichweite. All das gaukelt eine Rezeption, gaukelt eine Zustimmung vor, die gar nicht gegeben ist und verzerrt damit Realität. Und das ist der Grund, warum ich an der Stelle auch sage, das hat mit Redefreiheit überhaupt nichts mehr zu tun. Im Gegenteil, aus meiner Sicht schränkt es die Meinungsfreiheit, schränkt es die Redefreiheit ein. Und deswegen müssen wir an der Stelle auch aktiv werden, weil diese gezielte Verzerrung des Diskurses ist ja nicht mehr nur noch Sache von Diskussion oder politischen Gruppierungen, sondern sie ist auch, man muss es leider so sagen, mittlerweile Mittel hybrider Kriegführung. Das haben wir festgestellt. Wenn man jetzt nun ansieht, wo wird diese Diskussion ganz konkret, dann sind das jetzt genau die richtigen Tage, um das zu diskutieren. Denn ich habe die letzten Wochen erlebt, wenn ich in Brüssel war, dass mancher, der sich vor 6 Monaten noch über die Rede von JD Vance wahnsinnig empört hat, jetzt allzu willfährig bereit ist, europäische Regulierung in diesem Bereich im Rahmen der Zollverhandlungen zur Disposition zu stellen. Und da muss ich ganz ehrlich sagen, das dürfen wir nicht tun. Wir reden hier über den Kern vom Kern europäischer Identität, wenn es um die Verbindung von Freiheit und Verantwortung geht. Und deswegen müssen wir an der Stelle einen klaren Strich ziehen. Dass Zölle, mit Blick jetzt auch auf den Brief der Trump-Administration gestern oder die letzten Tage, eine Hiobsbotschaft für unsere Wirtschaft, sind, ist doch völlig klar. Aber es kann nicht sein, dass wir an der Stelle bereit sind, sozusagen Dinge in Frage zu stellen, die aus meiner Sicht noch wertvoller sind als wirtschaftliche Güter. Und deswegen darf das nicht zur Verhandlungsmasse werden im aktuellen Zollkonflikt. Das ist jetzt eher talking to ourselves als zu amerikanischen Freunden. Denn wir müssen an der Stelle vor allen Dingen die Stellung halten, ein schneller Quick-Win zur Deeskalation mit dem Team Trump, der würde hier an der Stelle unvorstellbare gesellschaftliche Folgekosten nach sich ziehen. Und ich glaube vielmehr, wir sollten selbstbewusst dagegenhalten. Denn wir haben eine Marktmacht von über 400 Millionen Kunden. Und ich sage mal so, wenn am Ende für die Trump-Administration nur die Währung zählt, wie viele potenzielle Kunden wir sind, dann müssen wir halt zur Not diese Karte spielen. Klar ist allerdings, wir müssen hier erst einmal die Position aufrechterhalten. Wenn man das so wahrnimmt und ein System, ein Thema unter Druck sieht, dann braucht man an der Stelle, glaube ich, nicht Sorge haben, dass wir völlig ungewappnet wären, auch wenn es ein ungleicher Konflikt ist mit Blick auf die Macht der großen Big Tech-Konzerne. Ich glaube, unser stärkstes Schutzschild gegen Desinformation ist erst einmal unsere vielfältige Medienlandschaft. Wir haben nach wie vor in Deutschland und Europa eine im internationalen Vergleich recht vielfältige Medienlandschaft. Natürlich steht die wirtschaftlich unter Druck in Zeiten von Digitalisierung, von KI. Das ist alles völlig klar. Und deswegen müssen wir aus meiner Sicht auch uns der Frage zuwenden, was wir tun können, um diese vielfältige Medienlandschaft zu erhalten. Und darüber wird momentan, zumindest in Deutschland, aber ich glaube auch in anderen europäischen Ländern diskutiert, mit Blick auf eine Digitalabgabe. Das ist aus meiner Sicht auch dringend notwendig, denn wir müssen hier entsprechend die Plattformen, die sich an diesen Inhalten bedienen in Europa, auch zur Kasse bitten und daran beteiligen, an den Kosten, diese Vielfalt zu erhalten. Sonst haben wir außerdem die bestehende Regulierung. Digital Services Act wurde schon genannt. Die ersten 10 Verfahren laufen. Wir müssen jetzt einmal diese Verfahren auch wirklich zum Ende führen, zeigen, dass diese Regulierung auch Zähne hat. Ich habe mit Frau Fürkun darüber gesprochen. Die sagt einem dann, dass man mit den Plattformen in guten Gesprächen ist. Das ist ja auch erstmal gut. Aber wir müssen an der Stelle auch klar machen, wir sind wild entschlossen, diese Regulierung auch durchzusetzen. Das tun wir im Übrigen auch hier im Land Nordrhein-Westfalen. Es sind im Übrigen in Deutschland die Länder, die für den Vollzug zuständig sind. Wir setzen nicht zuletzt mit dem Einsatz auch künstlicher Intelligenz die Regeln des DSA im Netz durch. Wir tun das gemeinsam mit dem Bund, wo im Koalitionsvertrag viele Dinge dazu festgeschrieben sind. Aber wir tun das auch mit vielen Gleichgesinnten auf der europäischen Ebene und wie ich finde, glücklicherweise auch parteiübergreifend. Und in dem Sinne freue ich mich auf die Ausführungen von Alexandra Gese. Dankeschön.
Ganz herzlichen Dank auch für die wichtigen europäischen Linienziehungen hier. Ich bin mir sicher, Alexander Gese wird das gleich aufnehmen. Nochmal die Bitte an alle, die Originalsprache verstehen, Deutsch und Englisch, nutzt gerne den YouTube-Link. Da könnt ihr auch alles hören, dass wir noch ein bisschen Platz für die gedolmetschte Version haben. Und dann übergebe ich jetzt an Alexandra Gese, die vielen von euch keine Unbekannte hier im Webinar ist. Sie ist digitalpolitische Expertin für die grüne EFA-Fraktion im Europaparlament. Sie hat den Digital Services Act, den wir jetzt schon ganz oft angesprochen haben, mitverhandelt. She was in the room when it happened und ist Gründungsvorständin auch von Europe Calling. Und Alexandra, wir freuen uns auf deine Remarks.
Ja, vielen Dank, Max, für die Einführung und einen wunderschönen Abend und hallo an alle, die heute Abend mit reinhören und gleich mit uns diskutieren. Liebe Nina, ich freue mich sehr, dass du da bist. Ich bin übrigens heute gerade in Cambridge, wo wir uns kennengelernt haben. Übrigens ist es hier an der Business School, weil Desinformation eben auch ein systemisches Risiko für die Wirtschaft ist, um ein bisschen aufzugreifen. Herr Leminski, ich grüße Sie auch sehr herzlich. Ich freue mich sehr, dass Sie dabei sind, hier parteiübergreifend. Und deswegen teile ich vollkommen Ihre Ausführungen, dass man sich jetzt nicht daran aufhalten kann und wichtige Durchsetzungsmaßnahmen stoppen kann, weil die USA mit Zöllen drohen, weil langfristig diese Situation, in der Desinformation sich stärker verbreitet als Information, nicht nur für unsere Demokratie, die auch für mich das extrem hohe Schutzgut ist, sondern im Endeffekt auch für unsere Wirtschaft sehr schädlich auswirken wird. Ich möchte noch mal sagen, hier geht es nicht nur um einzelne Desinformationskampagnen, seien sie ausländisch oder inländisch. Was hier eigentlich die Absicht ist, ist das Konzept von Fakten, das Konzept von wissenschaftlicher Evidenz, das Konzept von Wahrheit, als solches in Frage zu stellen und dafür zu sorgen, dass Menschen das nicht mehr feststellen können, dass also Fakten in der politischen und in der öffentlichen Debatte keine Rolle mehr spielen. Das erleben wir gerade in den USA mit den massiven Angriffen auf die Universitäten. Die Kontroverse um die Harvard-Universität ist ja nur die Spitze des Eisbergs, an der man das festmählich machen kann. Man sieht es an den massiven Angriffen auf Wissenschaftlerinnen, auf Wissenschaftler und Wissenschaftler, an die Zensur bei der Wissenschaft. Zu vielen Themen darf mit öffentlichen Mitteln gar nicht mehr erforscht werden. Zu einigen Dingen dürfen keine Fakten mehr erfasst werden, wie zum Beispiel extreme Wetterereignisse mit mehr als 1 Milliarde Schaden. Ja, und man kann sich ausmalen, was das auch für Versicherungen zum Beispiel bedeutet. Es ist also insgesamt diese Intention, Fakten als solche unzugänglich zu machen. Und das ist eine Gefahr für unsere Demokratie, die wir kaum überschätzen können. Warum ist Desinformation so erfolgreich geworden? Ja, es gab ja schon zu Zeiten der Sowjetunion Versuche mit Desinformation europäische, amerikanische Politik oder Politik weltweit massiv zu beeinflussen. Die waren aber in den meisten Fällen nicht so erfolgreich. Es hat was damit zu tun, dass die Algorithmen Desinformation bevorzugen. Wir haben das hier schon einige Male erklärt in diesem Raum von Europe Calling, aber ich glaube, es ist so wichtig und wir sagen immer wieder so viele Leute, hochgebildete Menschen, dass sie das noch nie gehört haben. Deswegen erkläre ich es gerne nochmal und damit kommen wir auch direkt zur ersten Lösung. Im Moment wird Desinformation an mehr Menschen ausgespielt als Information in den meisten Fällen in den sozialen Netzwerken. Die Presse hält noch dagegen, wird aber auch immer stärker von diesem Mechanismus beeinflusst. Woran liegt das? Das liegt daran, dass die Social Media Unternehmen natürlich ihre Einnahmen optimieren wollen, ihren Gewinn optimieren wollen. Das machen sie dadurch, dass sie uns Werbung zeigen. Deshalb haben sie ein Interesse daran, uns so lange wie möglich auf der Plattform zu halten. Wir bleiben länger auf der Plattform, wenn wir mit Inhalt interagieren, das heißt, wenn wir einen Post teilen, langen Kommentar drunter schreiben. Und das machen wir am ehesten, wenn wir negative Emotionen wie Angst und Wut empfinden. Das liegt daran, dass das Emotionen sind, bei denen es wichtig ist, wenn man in der Natur ist, zum Beispiel, dass man schnell handelt, wenn ein wildes Tier auf einen zugerannt kommt. Ja, das sind die Menschen, die aus der Steinzeit überlebt haben. Das sind unsere Vorfahren, was also in vielen Situationen eine sehr sinnvolle Reaktion ist, sich zu schützen und zu handeln. Auch Angst und Wut wird im Internet zu einem Mechanismus, der Desinformation fördert, weil die sozialen Medien dann sagen, dieser Content, dieser Post, dieser Tweet wird an mehr Menschen rausgeschickt und dadurch verbreitet er sich stärker. Und das ist natürlich ein Anreiz für die Politik zum Beispiel, auch stärker mit Lügen, mit starken negativen Emotionen zu arbeiten, weil man darüber eine höhere Sichtbarkeit bekommt und auch in Talkshows kommt. Diesen Mechanismus können wir aber unterbrechen. Und damit komme ich zum Bereich Lösung. Wir haben den Digital Services Act auf europäischer Ebene. Wir können uns wehren. In den USA ist es viel schwerer. Wir haben eine klare Rechtsgrundlage, um uns in einem Rechtsstaat gegen diesen Mechanismus zu wehren. Und es gibt einen Artikel, das ist der Artikel 34, der sagt, wenn es systemische Risiken gibt, die von der Plattform ausgelöst werden, zum Beispiel für Grundrechte, zum Beispiel für öffentliche Gesundheit, aber auch für öffentlichen Diskurs und Wahlen, sprich für Demokratie, dann kann die Kommission Ermittlungen einleiten, prüfen, was dieses systemische Risiko ist und kann dann Maßnahmen ergreifen, um dieses systemische Risiko abzustellen. Und ich glaube, viele von uns in diesem Raum sind sich einig, dass die Tatsache, dass Desinformation sich stärker verbreitet in sozialen Medien als Information, ein systemisches Risiko für unsere Demokratie ist. Steht übrigens ganz ähnlich auch im Koalitionsvertrag und wird von sehr vielen Menschen in unserem Land und in ganz Europa geteilt. Deswegen sollte diese Ermittlung sofort eingeleitet werden. Die Ermittlungen werden wahrscheinlich zu dem Schluss kommen, dass interaktionsbasiertes Ranking, das ist der Mechanismus, den ich gerade erklärt habe, wenn mehr Menschen auf einen Inhalt draufklicken, einen langen Kommentar drunter schreiben, oder bei TikTok ihn einfach nur lange anschauen, dann wird er mehr Menschen gezeigt, dass das der Hauptmechanismus ist, der diese stärkere Verbreitung von Desinformation auslöst. Das führt eben auch dazu, dass jeder Influencer, der mit Verschwörungsnarrativen arbeitet oder mit rechtsextremen falschen Erzählungen, mehr Verbreitung bekommt als Presse, die seriös recherchieren muss und die sich eben an die Fakten halten muss. Das heißt, es ist auch ein riesiges Problem langfristig für unsere Medienlandschaft, weil sie eben auch immer mehr Sichtbarkeit im Internet verliert, gleichzeitig aber immer stärker auf die Einnahmen aus dem Internet angewiesen ist. So, jetzt kann die Europäische Union könnte einfach, die Europäische Kommission könnte einfach ohne weiteren parlamentarischen Beschluss, das Gesetz ist schon da, diese Ermittlung einleiten und diesen Mechanismus abstellen und durch die Plattform auffordern, diesen Algorithmus durch andere zu ersetzen, der den bewusst ausgedrückten NutzerInnenwillen, also die bewussten Entscheidungen, die wir treffen, im Internet viel stärker zu berücksichtigen. Und das heißt eben nicht, dass ich ein Video anschaue oder teile, weil es mir Angst macht, ja, sondern dass ich vorher in der Lage bin, zu sagen, ich möchte zum Beispiel diese und diese Medien sehen, ja. Ich möchte Medieninhalte sehen, die sich an journalistische Standards halten, die seriös recherchieren. Oder ich möchte etwas zu meinen Hobbys sehen und das sind eins, zwei, drei. und ich sich da einfach eine Auswahl treffen kann. Das ist eine andere Möglichkeit, die unsere Meinungsfreiheit im Internet massiv erhöht. Das würde nämlich bedeuten, dass die Inhalte nicht von Mark Zuckerberg oder von Elon Musk oder unter Umständen von der chinesischen Regierung ausgesucht werden, sondern von uns allen selber für das, was uns interessiert. Und wenn ihr diese Lösung unterstützen wollt, dann könnt ihr eine Petition unterschreiben, die seit gestern läuft. Die Petition nennt sich Freiheit für Fakten. Da geht es darum, genau das zu fordern, was ich gerade erklärt habe und wo wir damit sorgen können, dass Fakten wieder eine echte Chance haben, Menschen zu erreichen. Denn die Meinungsfreiheit schließt ja auch das Recht ein, sich zu informieren, das Recht, mehr Informationen auf den ersten Blick im Netz zu finden, in den sozialen Medien zu finden, als Verschwörungserzählungen, Lügen oder sogar gezielte Propaganda und Desinformation. Also unterschreibt gerne die Petition. Max, du stellst es bestimmt gerne den Link in den Chat und das ist eure Chance, euch einzubringen, das zu unterzeichnen, das weiter zu verbreiten, diese Geschichte weiter zu erzählen. Wir können eine relativ einfache Lösung jetzt finden. Wir müssen es einfach nur tun. Die Kommission, Europäische Kommission muss es nur tun. Dafür können sich auch die Bundesländer engagieren, die ja gerade im Bereich Medien sehr umfassende Kompetenzen haben. Und ich könnte mir gut vorstellen, dass auch der Bundesrat zum Beispiel einen Beschluss dazu trifft, die Bundesregierung auffordert, sich bei der Europäischen Kommission genau in diese Richtung einzusetzen. Und ich habe diese Idee auch schon an mehrere Regierungen in ganz Europa eingereicht. Damit könnte die Bundesregierung zum Beispiel auch sich zum Beispiel mit der französischen Regierung, Macron, haben wir ja vorhin in der Einführung gehört, hat sich auch stark für Maßnahmen ausgesprochen. Da könnte ich mir gut mal eine gemeinsame Initiative zum Beispiel der Bundesregierung und Frankreich, Spanien, Polen vorstellen, sich in diesem Sinne die Kommission aufzufordern, diese sehr konkrete Maßnahme zu treffen. Warum macht die Kommission das nicht selber? Herr Leminski hat das gerade schon ausgeführt. Sie hat Angst vor den USA. Trump droht Europa damit, höhere Zölle, noch höhere Zölle zu fordern. Ich meine, es kommt ja jeden Tag irgendwie neue Zölle. Er will, dass Europa keine Digitalsteuer einführt. Er will, dass amerikanische Unternehmen, die unsere Digitalgesetze verletzen, keine Geldstrafen zahlen müssen. Also fordert im Prinzip einen rechtsfreien Raum für amerikanische Unternehmen. Man stelle sich vor, die Bundesregierung würde das für deutsche Unternehmen in den USA fordern. Und es wird darauf bestanden, dass von amerikanischer Seite, dass jede Form von Digitalregulierung Zensur ist und eine Einschränkung der Meinungsfreiheit. Und da finde ich, gerade zu diesem Thema Meinungsfreiheit müssen wir sehr klar den Diskurs wieder in unsere eigene Hand nehmen. Also bereits 1721, als der Begriff der Meinungsfreiheit das erste Mal eingebracht wurde, hieß es, die Meinungsfreiheit darf aber nie die Freiheit des anderen einschränken oder diesem Schaden zufügen. Und das setzen wir in Deutschland sehr gut um. Ich würde aber noch viel weiter gehen und viel offensiver sein und sagen, wenn Milliardäre wie Zuckerberg oder Musk über die Algorithmen entscheiden können, dass wir in der Mehrheit Desinformation oder Angst- und wutbesetzte Inhalte sehen, dann heißt das ja im Umkehrschluss auch, dass alle anderen Inhalte unterdrückt werden. Und dafür gibt es sehr klare Zahlen aus dem deutschen Wahlkampf. Und das hat nichts mit Meinungsfreiheit zu tun. Das ist die Meinungsfreiheit von wenigen Milliardären, aber nicht unsere Meinungsfreiheit. Das heißt also gerade die Art und Weise, wie soziale Medien heute funktionieren und diese Algorithmen unterdrücken unsere Meinungsfreiheit. Zweitens die Tatsache, dass Hass und Hetze eingesetzt werden gegen politische Gegner, gegen Minderheiten, gegen Frauen im Netz, reduziert die Meinungsfreiheit aller betroffenen Personen und manipuliert den öffentlichen und politischen Raum, vertreibt sehr, sehr viele Menschen aus dem öffentlichen Diskurs. Und das hat nichts mit Meinungsfreiheit zu tun. Dagegen müssen wir ganz, ganz klar vorgehen. So, das war schon mal mein Lösungsvorschlag. Ich habe noch ein paar mehr. Ich würde gerne auf das Thema Medienlandschaft eingehen, aber meine Zeit ist um und ich freue mich auf eure Fragen und auf die Diskussion.
Ja, vielen, vielen Dank. Oh, so yes, we are switching to English. I forgot, so I need to switch to English as well. So thanks so much. We have many, many questions, 50 at the moment, with a lot of likes on them, and we also have some hands. So how are we going to do this Q&A? So I'm trying to get as many questions from the audience in, and then here on the panel, you can use your hand up button, or you just show your hand. I will also see your hand if you want to say something. Not everyone has to talk to all the points. I might give some questions specifically to people, but we can be a bit interactive here in the room, and you can take your space. I mean, there are many, many topics we have. I heard, you know, the issue of press and media. We spoke about algorithms, and we also get many questions about, you know, about what something that Nina also pointed out to is about, you know, teaching people, education, about how those mechanisms work as well. So this is one point I want to talk to you about as well. Also, you know, when it comes to when it comes to big tech and you know, the fight back that Mr. Leminski was referring to, that we are not butching down. It's really important. But I really want to know something more about this, and the audience as well. So, but I want to start with the top question, and this is a question for Mr. Leminski, and I think I will also want to widen it a bit. So, and of course, you know, if you follow the German discussion, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, the selection of the Supreme Court justices at the moment. There was a right-wing campaign against one of the candidates, also a disinformation campaign. She was yesterday in a big German talk show, and so one of our guests, and this is actually the top questions with a lot of distance. The person asked, in this smear campaign against this Prosius Gerstorf, which is the justice fueled by far-right neos, relevant and also relevant CDU representatives that are actively involved in downplaying and remaining silent on the matter. How can you currently credibly stand for the protection of democracy against disinformation? This is the top caption. I want to give this to Mr. Leminski as kind of the question on the topic, but I would also like to open it, because I think the question is also, how do political parties and the political actors deal in a climate of misinformation, right? Because we are in this climate, this is very prolific. So how should political parties deal with it? So maybe Mr. Leminski first, and then I want to open up to Nina and Alexandra. You're muted, Mr. Leminski.
Okay, here you go. Well, to start with this question, which indeed is heavily discussed in German politics right now, we first have to acknowledge that, as I said, in a free democracy, you have the right to criticize the positions for people being nominated for public offices. And there has been criticism of the positions of this judge, not just from the far right networks. And so we should be cautious in discriminating every criticism as a result or as a product of far-right disinformation or far-right media networks. Because if we do this, people who criticize that out of any conviction, let's take Christian convictions or others, they feel themselves being presented as lunatics, and in the end they will end up criticizing that they cannot speak open anymore in our society. So I really would urge all of us to keep the freedom of the discussion by also acknowledging and allowing that there are different positions on the questions which were discussed on all of this. At the same time, we also have to be realistic that, of course, you can see that there have been actions taken by far-right networks to create or to organize some kind of hunt against this judge. So I can fully understand that he criticizes the way she was confronted by many people from the far right networks, and also others who took over that kind of argumentation. and criticism. So I hope that in the end we will find back to a way of discussing issues like that in a decent way. And we can see that if we don't do this, in the end, it will hurt institutions which are very important, which are crucial for the functioning of a democracy. And that's something we as politicians have to be a role model for. And so I try, and our state government tries to do it itself, so that we can warn others not to do it differently.
Thank you very much. Maybe just to keep, with a bit of a German focus, so I take Alexandra first and then open up to Nina to kind of the view of kind of the extreme example that we have in the US right now, which I think is even pushing this a bit forward. But I think, without probably knowing the details of it, this sounds probably very familiar to Nina. Alexandra.
Yes, thank you. I agree with Mr. Leminski on that we should have that conversation in a decent way. I disagree with the fact that this is what happened. I think this is really an example of a MAGA style, a Jim Jordan style witch hunt against one specific person, which used important pieces of disinformation, like, for example, stating that she was in favor of a total right to abortion until up to the 9th month, which is a very unpopular opinion in Germany. And this was a total lie because what her paper actually said is a very differentiated and very nuanced approach, which is exactly what 74% of Germans say that is the position they agree on. And that was not in the media until she made that TV statement. There were also allegations that she had copied part of her PhD thesis, which are clearly untrue because the paper she seems to have copied from came out 3 years later. And there's a very strongly gendered aspect to this. It's a lot easier to get so hard against a woman than a man. So I think this is really a typical example of a witch hunt. And it's a typical example of how quickly you can turn things around and create damage, even if now the decision has been postponed, but the damage is done anyway. So I think this is exactly what should not happen in this case. And I think this is a very serious precedent for German institutions, who used to be a little bit boring, but that was a good thing. The one thing there where I would agree and what we should avoid is we shouldn't be shaming people. I think that is a point where we have, like, on the progressive side to criticize a little bit ourselves. Because one thing that is very much ignored around the whole disinformation issue is the role of emotions. So why do people believe disinformation? Because there's a lot of emotions. I don't have the time to go into this, but emotions like shame and pride and the want to control things in the poly crisis, I think that are very, very important emotions, and we should be very, very careful on how we communicate and who we are inclusive with, who we try to exclude from a space. So also on our side, I think this is really important to take into account. I don't think it's relevant in this specific case around the constitutional judge, but on a general level, I think this is really one issue that progressive have was communication, that we don't understand the role of emotions and not shaming people while stating that other people have rights, and this is something we need to look into.
Thank you. Giving that to Nina.
This is a really interesting case, and you're right that I hear a lot of echoes in the rhetoric that we've seen coming from the MAGA movement here in the United States. One of the things that's been most frustrating to me throughout the past 8 years has been the embrace of disinformation as a political tactic. Now, people will say that politicians have always lied, right? But there's a difference between campaign statements that are maybe a little bit misleading and the full scale directed at the most vulnerable, very, pinpointed disinformation that we see being emboldened by the social media platforms today. And I have been frustrated both with individuals within the Republican Party who stood strong against then candidate Trump back in 2015 and 2016, even to people who criticized him during his first term, who are now in his cabinet, to the Democrats as well, for not standing strong enough against the type of manipulation that we're seeing here. And since it's relevant to the conversation about this judge, against gendered violence as well. There was an example not too long ago when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was called, excuse me for cursing, but a bitch by one of her Republican colleagues on the steps of the Capitol. And there was a censure vote, and he was not censured. If this is the way that politicians are behaving, and of course that behavior is endorsed by the commander in chief, if disinformation becomes a part of a normal part of political warfare, let's call it, then our democracy cannot function, as I mentioned before. It cannot function. Politicians will lose trust, and trust for politicians is already in the tank. People will start to behave worse, and we're seeing that not only in how people treat each other online, but also in real extrajudicial physical violence here in the United States. Just a month ago, a state representative in Minnesota was shot dead along with her husband and her golden retriever dog because of her stance on things like women's rights and access to healthcare. And as someone who's been threatened online, I think about that a lot. I think about that a lot, and this is not the only incident of political violence that we've seen or that we're going to see. And so my point is, I think it is really important for politicians to stand strong and say, you know what, we recognize that disinformation knows no political party, that when the other side uses it against us, one day, we cannot use it against them because what comes around goes around, as we say in English, right? And that it is just a scourge to our systems functioning as they are meant to function. We need our politicians, although that this, from time immemorial, politicians have not necessarily been always the paragon of behavior, but that is what we should, I'm thinking of some Roman emperors, not even recent politicians, but we should have politicians that, inspire the best in their populations. And that starts with how we treat each other as human beings and falling through on our actions and making sure that lying is not taking place. And it is of grave disappointment to me that the Democrats have not found a way to call this out, but also not engage in it themselves. There were some behaviors in the campaign last year that I thought were too much fighting fire with fire and led us to a very a difficult place as a party. And so now I'm kind of hands off of all of that, but that's my message to any politicians that might be listening.
I want to take that on and move a bit to the solutions part of it. So, what are the extra strategies to combat that? And we actually have a question in the chat actually from Portugal, which I always love to have questions that are in English, not from Germany. And Maria João Nogueira from Portugal asked, shouldn't the Finnish strategy, the strategy from Finland of teaching critical thinking from a very young age in schools be adopted everywhere? And isn't education the only real way to combat and mitigate disinformation? And I want to combine this with something that is actually happening right now. We have in Europe, we have a very big discussion, and in other parts as well, but the European Parliament, the Commission, about age restrictions. So, there are obviously the two options. Do you teach people, kids by, all the adolescents, and then of course the adults, to teach them how to use it or to use it better, which for me is always a bit paternalistic in a way, has always this sound to it. Or do you do, or like Australia, I think, did it now, they're basically just banning from a different age. So I want to get this discussion here. So what do we do? Do we educate? Do we ban? Do we maybe ban the platforms, ban the algorithms? So how do we protect people? And I saw the hand from Mr. Leminski and would want to take him first on that issue of education age. Yes, please.
First of all, thanks for this very important question, because I left this part out from my statement that I'm absolutely convinced that we have to put much more effort in the education, how to use media, how to really reflect on them, and because otherwise The kids of today won't be able to tackle the flood of information, even disinformation as well, in the future. And we at the state have done already a lot by developing programs or websites, offering people the possibility to test themselves, so to see where they are strong on media competence and where they are weak. And where they are weak, they are shown certain offers of private or public institutions, how to improve their techniques, their competence when it comes to media use. And I think that's the way we should go, but in a much broader scale. We scaled it up the last years. We have scaled it up, but there's still a long way to go. Second, to the question of banning social media. I'm a father of four, so I know what I'm talking about. Our oldest is 15 years old, our second child 12 years old. So they are in touch with all of this. And I can fully understand everyone who says, you know, social media is so dangerous, we should ban it for children under the age of 16. And there are evenings and weekends when I am part of this team who wants to ban it. But at the same time, every regulation has to stand the test, whether it is possible to implement it technically with a generation of digital natives, whether it is possible to enforce it when it comes to the rule of law. I mean, it's a deep interference in the personal rights and the right for information of young people, but also politically. We have to make sure that we don't find regulation which divides the society in those who are young and those who are old, or in those who are digital natives or people who care about, and those who do not care about because they don't need it for their life. And so what I really would urge us in a free democracy, the ban should always be the last resort, the last option. And I don't see many politicians being ready to at least try to develop a regulation between the status of now and the banning. And when I talk to the platforms, I always say, you know, the ban is on the table. It should be an option if they don't move, if they don't get along with their responsibility. But we have to really do the work to find regulation in between, which would stand all those measures, which would stand all those criteria I just mentioned.
I'll come in next. So I want to make clear that education, while I'm a huge proponent of it, of building information literacy, it's not a panacea. It needs to work in conjunction with smart regulation related to oversight and transparency of social media platforms, of advertisers, et cetera, and also support for public media, right? We're having that debate here. I haven't mentioned that at all today, but the fact that President Trump is trying to yank about $1 billion, I think, from public media that has already been allocated for this financial year is deeply troubling to me, because many of your viewers might know that we spend about $1.80, I think, per person per year. It might even be less than that now, on our public media. Compared to what European nations spend for public media that is robust, that informs people, that people turn to in a time of crisis, it's just shameful. That being said, I do think it is incredibly important that we invest in information literacy. And I understand, Max, that it might sound a little bit paternalistic, but it's the same sort of thing about informing people. Let's say, you know, we've all gotten the emails from Nigerian princes who are promising us $1 million, right? This is Nigerian princes on a massive targeted scale. And it's not that people don't know, they have been misled by billion-dollar corporations whose job it is to mislead them so that they can continue to increase engagement and increase their profit share, right? And that's where I differ a little bit with Mr. Leminski. A lot of people do think of this as a school-age problem. That's the easiest way to solve it, right? Teach the kids, but what does that do for us today? What, how does that change how voting age adults are behaving? And here's where I think, again, our friends in Eastern Europe have some lessons for us, not just the Finns, who have had a robust information literacy program, as the question from Portugal mentioned, since you know, a couple of decades, but folks in the Czech Republic, in Ukraine and in Georgia have done some really interesting work with information literacy that targets adults. So in the Czech Republic, when I was researching for my book, I heard about efforts to teach especially older adults, so let's say retirees and pensioners, basic skills about how to use an iPad, how to video call your grandchildren. And in those trainings would be a little bit on information literacy. So they weren't necessarily signing up for a whole information, you know, literacy course, but it was a little bit about how to find trustworthy information on the internet. In Georgia, our friends there in civil society organized infotainment. So they would train a bunch of comedians or musicians or actors in how to spot disinformation. They would send them back to their home cities, towns outside of Tbilisi, and they would then put on a show that would be funded by that organization. And within the material that they were presenting, which would include, you know, popular material, comedy sets, etc., it would include some information about how to, again, navigate today's information environment. This is the sort of thing that we need to think creatively about. And the last thing I'll say on information literacy is that it's important that when we're offering these programs and perhaps when, you know, the EU is funding them or local governments are funding them, that they are partnering with local organizations, because nothing is worse than somebody flying in from a capital, parachuting in and saying to folks in a small town, this is what you should think, and I'm so worldly and smart and wise, and you should listen to me because of that. No, they want to hear that, and this is proven by decades of research as well. They want to hear that from leaders in their community, whether that's a faith leader, whether that is, you know, in the United States, veterans organizations are quite respected. Find those local leaders that might be able to deliver that message to communities that they know and put it in the context that makes sense for them. Very quickly on bans, I'm a big fan of Australia in general and the way they've approached tech regulation. I am not a fan of this ban. As a millennial, a digital, practically a digital native, I found a lot of community on the internet as a kid. And I've seen the worst of what the internet has to offer. I know it is difficult, but one of the things that we need to do is empower parents to teach their kids about how to navigate the internet and how to do that safely, empower educators to do that as well. And I think, as Mr. Leminski said, kids are going to find ways around bans, just as, you know, we find ways around other banned content, VPNs, and other things. We need the platforms to be upholding their duty of care to young adults. And that's another area for regulation, I think, making sure the onus is on the platforms, not removing, you know, the rights of children to express themselves online. Rather than just take that away, we need to put the onus on the platforms and make sure they're not being shown content that is inappropriate for them or harmful for them in other ways. And that's a really big lift, but it's something a lot of regulators have been thinking about for a while, and there's room there for improvement.
Thank you. Giving over to Alexandra. I know Alexandra spends a lot of time in schools as well, being invited as a member of the parliament to many schools and talking to young people about this topic. So when you explain to them how the algorithms work, what is their response?
They say, oh, yeah, we know that, but it's so addictive, we just can't put it down. And I think that's a little bit the problem, that we base our ideas on very reasonable ideas, but the psychological mechanisms that these social media companies, who employ thousands and thousands of psychologists who try to figure out how to make us stay more time on the platforms, they are so strong. And the kids say that very openly. You know, very few of adults admit, you know, I was hooked on my phone or spent half an hour and didn't even see it pass. But the kids just say that very clearly and say it's so addictive. You know, we know this is not good information. I mean, they don't even see much really info content. You know, when I went to school, when the European campaign started last year, I went to school, and the first school told the kids told me, you know what we see all day? Accidents with people dying. We see people dying, but you know, by the hundreds. And it's like, it's so shocking. And now I wonder, you know, how can we face that with the idea of media literacy? How do we tell them, well, don't do that? You know, they get that the algorithm puts that content out there, out there, out there again and again. You know, this is not between choosing an article from a serious newspaper or some conspirational theory. This is what the algorithm gives them. And therefore, I think media literacy is super important. Information literacy is super important, but it's more about deconstructing the mechanisms, as Nina said before. You know, the European Commission, they still say, well, people have to learn to check their sources, but people will choose sources that resonate with their emotional needs. And that might not be exactly the most exact information and the best research journalistic content. So I think it's about deconstruction, but this is not going to work if we don't build a social media world or an information ecosystem in which facts have a fair chance. And right now for kids, they don't. And kids are usually pretty media literate, a lot more than people in my generation and older, frankly. As long as the algorithms always put that kind of content out there, it's very hard to defend yourself against that. And there's something on top, and Nina mentioned that briefly. Large language models are being fed by these algorithms with disinformation, as well as by deliberate disinformation campaigns by countries like Russia. And what kids actually do is they use ChatGPT or other AI chatbots. And there's no way with media literacy that you can verify whether that information is correct or not. And 30% of the cases, it is not correct. It's very often incorrect. But that's super hard to understand. So how do we use media literacy there? I think that we need some regulation. Just a very quick thing in the end, on the schools, since Mr. Leminski is here, I mean, schools are overwhelmed by tasks and it's very hard for schools. I agree schools should do that, but it's very easy to say, you know, there are companies that make each one 100 billion a year. They cause huge societal harms and damage to kids. And then schools in the target countries where these companies don't pay taxes have to find a solution and change people's minds and put that knowledge in there and work with their emotions. And I think Mr. Leminski is very well aware of what's happening to the budget of North Rhine-Westphalia. We just don't have that money. We don't have the teachers. We don't have those capacities. I mean, we can tell teachers they should do that. We can tell schools that they should do it. But it's not happening anytime soon in a scale that we need if we don't get massive funding for this. And this is why we need the digital tax, for example.
And I think getting Mr. Leminski in here again, you also mentioned the digital tax, Digitalabgabe, especially in the regard to press and media. Maybe you can elaborate a bit more, and also about the question here about the, you know, you said the, you know, the social media platforms using this as a business model to make a lot of money. So what can politics do to, you know, interfere, or, you know, at least if it's a business, then, you know, businesses are taxed for a good reason to provide public services. So what? Maybe elaborate a bit more if you can, please.
Yes, of course. I'd like to do that. As I said in my statement, I think we have to acknowledge the situation that all the budgets for advertisement are going to big tech. In the last years, it's over 50% of the budget went away from the, let's say, classic German media. To these big tech firms. And this means that the media landscape changes a lot. And so in order to have still a variety of media outlets, we need to find new sources of refinancing. And at the same time, we see that the big tech, the platforms using are using the content being created by others. And so I think that we have to find a way to get them to participate in the financing of these of the creating of these content. And this is by probably not the right way would be a tax, but would be something like similar. I don't know the English word to be honest for Abgabe. we need something which they have to give, and this has to be designated to strengthen the media landscape in Germany. But I would be also open to what Alexandra Gese just said, if parts of it would be designated to media literacy projects, because I also think that the strongest way to regulate the media landscape would be to have responsible users who know to differentiate between fake news and serious information. And this is the reason why I'm so convinced that although it's a big task or a big challenge, we shouldn't give up in really educating in a broad scale, in a wide scale, the children and youth. But as Nina just said, I absolutely agree, our programs should always cover the whole society. That's why the things we do not just concentrate on schools, but also on the media literacy of all generations. It's absolutely right to do so. And let me perhaps add one last thing, which I forgot in my last statement. It's about the thing of making sure that young people do not use those programs or apps and others which are not designed for them. We in our media state treaty, we just as states, as 16 states in Germany, we have convened on the decision that we need to have an age verification system on all on all measure not measures on every cell phone, on every
Nice.
mobile device, exactly, mobile device you are using. And we are going to introduce that in Germany now. And I think that's a very powerful instrument to make sure that it's easier also for parents to make sure that that we can really enforce age verification.
Thank you. You may be wondering, the audience, why I'm not calling so many named questions. So I have Amelie in the background who kind of is clustering those questions for me. So I know how many are coming roughly from each area. So this is a bit of a, this is clustering involved here. So don't be surprised that you don't hear your name, but your question might be coming up in this kind of clustering. And I wanna go in there where Mr. Leminski also mentioned, one of the ways, and or you all mentioned artificial intelligence, because education is one thing, but artificial intelligence, the large language models are designed to be actually quite superior in terms of of the human brain, especially in easy tasks and easy information. We all know that when we are using those tools. And so the question, we've heard a bit about how AI is used as a tool to feed or to feed disinformation into platforms. So, but is it possible that also artificial intelligence can also be a tool against that? So if they are working with it, should we fight it with it, or is that the fire that that you said we shouldn't use? So is AI maybe the solution against the AI problem?
If you ask Mark Zuckerberg, I'm sure he'd say yes. In fact, as early as 2018, in his first hearing in front of the Senate, I believe he was saying about, AI tools are going to allow us to expand our content moderation. Look, the reality is that humans are smarter than AI, and that AI might eventually reach our level of nuance and understanding and subject matter expertise and cultural lingo, but it's not there yet. And so while I have used AI tools in order to analyze large data sets, particularly of hate speech that I don't want to have to go through and expose myself to, I do a check by hand and I manually code to make sure that it didn't make mistakes. And in one paper I did last year around this time with a similar data set, it was off by like 10% encoding what was hate speech and negative harassing content online. So I don't think we're there yet. And the other thing is we have these models hallucinating so frequently. They can be so easily jailbroke. They can include the, as we've seen with Grok, X's AI tool very recently, influenced by the people who own the platforms, in some ways more noticeably and overtly than others. I just don't think that solving this problem with a machine-based solution, particularly an industry that is already repeating so many of the mistakes that the early social media industry had, I think that it's going to compound the problem. AI is a tool. We need to use it as a tool, understand its limitations, and have a human in the loop. It might speed things up, but eventually, you will have to run to a brain with human cognition and empathy and understanding of nuance. And unfortunately, AI doesn't have that yet. In terms of detection, there are certainly detection tools for things like deepfakes. I'm pretty bullish on that. You are able to see that stuff more frequently. There's also a lot of movements to digitally watermark any edited audio and video so that people can say, oh, I see how this was edited, and then not necessarily trust things that lack a watermark. But the uptake on those tools hasn't been really expanded yet. And so that's a maybe a tomorrow solution, but not a today solution. Ultimately, I really do believe it comes down to individuals and then the power of individuals against platforms in order to ensure that we can fight back against this stuff. I wouldn't say I'm a doomer on AI. I do use it, but I don't think it's going to solve this crisis the way that some people might hope it does.
Thank you. I'm gonna put it the chat on the like AI and the in the a link on AI in the chat at the end. So it has a doomsday and a beautiful scenario on it. So that's something to read for the summer break. But I want to get Mr. Leminski in here on that question because I know that the state here, your state, where you're responsible for this, is actually using AI to identify, and maybe you can explain that better content, that is to be deleted. So what is your experience with that?
Yeah, you are right. Our agencies, which are responsible for enforcing DSA and other pieces of regulation, they have developed a technique using AI to detect more cases like Nina just described. But Nina's absolutely right that we still have to, in the end, go through it hand by hand, because the AI still makes failures. There are still failures. So, but what we do is we can detect much more cases. And the other 15 states in Germany, they have taken this technique or this technology as well. Our Belgian neighbors, they have also asked to use it. And I know of other European countries being interested in it as well. It's called KIWI. That's the acronym to it. And this is the reason actually why the German state agencies are those who deliver the most cases when it comes to the European level, when it comes to enforcing DSA and other regulation. And that shows that AI can be helpful, can be used also for the good side, but we still have to follow up. And that's what we do, is not just to detect and to publish, but also to give it to the law enforcement and then really identify those people doing it, and in the end, being in front of their door, knocking the door, telling them, we know what you're doing. I mean, and of course, this means that you have to put in a lot of resources. And that's what we did, that's what we have done the last years, personnel, but also financing. And we also train the technology, new languages, Arabic now, and other languages, so that it really can identify and detect more cases.
Thank you. We have 5 minutes left. So Alexander, you will be next. Just wanted to announce how I want to end with you all, and we're going to do after Alexander do a final round on this. This is the question that you all kind of referred to, is that we have strong rules in Europe and we need to defend them against especially what's happening in the US and what Trump is doing. So I want to do a round with you at the end, and you can already start thinking about specifically saying what you personally can do and what you're doing and what the people in this room, we are still 800, there are 400, 500, 600 on YouTube as well. So what can people actually do if they want to defend the rules we have against the what the US is trying, what the Trump administration is trying to do? But Alexandra, on AI, and then I'm going to open the round to this final question.
Yeah, just briefly on AI. I think these detection artificial intelligence programs are great, absolutely, but they do need human oversight, as has been said. But the interesting thing about the detection instrument of the North Rhine-Westphalia State Media Oversight Authority is that they did it themselves, basically. It's not something they bought in the US, but it's built in Germany or in Europe at least, exactly to match the needs of that authority. And that is the interesting point, because the problem with AI in general is when you speak about AI, what we mostly mean is a handful of large language models built by exactly the same people that build social media and that control social media. And as you said, Nina Zuckerberg said in the US Congress, yeah, we will combat hate speech and whatever with artificial intelligence in the European Parliament. I remember an audition where somebody from the University of Munich, the Technical University, is famously funded heavily by Facebook, said, yeah, against hate speech, we're just going to produce a lot of counter speech with artificial intelligence. And imagine this internet where the bots are talking to the bots. And why should we as humans engage in this fight between bots? This totally doesn't make sense. It only makes sense for the advertising company that Facebook is, and not for anybody of us. So the problem with artificial intelligence is that it's the same people who control artificial intelligence and who control social media, and their interest is not at all keeping us safe. Their interest is taking money out of Europe, taking money out of us by keeping us riveted. So that's the problem. That brings me to another topic that's very dear to my heart, and I'm working on a European dialogue, that is European digital sovereignty. So what we should do in Europe is build our own tech instruments, build our own digital infrastructure, and that also means build our own artificial intelligence that whose aim, principal aim is not to increase our screen time, but to really build solutions that help us with our lives.
And there are many questions about that as well, actually, and we haven't covered them at all about, what is the alternative in terms of tech. And we're going to do another webinar on that, I think, because I think that's another very crucial point. So I want to, because we're running out of time, giving you 1 minute each, Nina, Mr. Leminski, Alexandra, and then we are finishing up. Nina.
Yeah, so I think in terms of what people can do, these platforms are not immune to pressure. We have seen pressure campaigns from users of these platforms amount to change before. So don't feel disempowered just because they have powerful allies. As Mr. Leminski said, I believe in his opening remarks, Europe is a powerful market for these companies. So make your voices heard. And one way that you can do that, in addition to kind of expressing your displeasure, calling your legislators to make sure that they're enforcing legislation, you can also report content that you see, right? A lot of these AI systems that they have are triggered when a lot of people are reporting similar content, whether that content is hate speech or something violent or disinformative, right? So don't be a passive online bystander, be an active online bystander, and communicate to these services that you're using, that are using you, that are monetizing your behavior. They work for you. You are not the product, right? Let's flip that script. And I think if we all start to do that, then we might see a more responsive tech landscape soon.
Mr. Leminski.
Well, first of all, I totally agree to what Nina just said, and I would like to add the whole part of research, because what we are now going to introduce into the DSA, or we have introduced already, is the possibility to find more data on how these platforms work. And of course, first of all, they have to give these data. I'm hoping that the European Union will enforce this part as well. But as soon as we have this data, we can know more, but we have to use it and also do research on it and also publish it so that we have a solid base to judge the behavior of those platforms and to find then ways to discuss it in public and of course develop regulation on it as well. And for doing so, we have to keep that issue in the public by events like tonight. We have to make it an issue, not leave it up to those platforms, and be self-confident that we are one of the most attractive markets all over the world. In Europe, and this means that there is a very, very strong possibility for us, an opportunity to have a strong voice on this development worldwide.
Thank you, Alexander Gitte.
Yeah, first thing, sign the petition, Freedom for Facts. This is how you can put pressure on politicians, on the European Commission. Share that. There's a brief explanation. So share that knowledge, do something, sign the petition, and tell people about how important that is and how the mechanisms works. It's explained there. Put pressure on politicians. This is a problem that politicians can't fix. They just need to feel the pressure from the public opinion that this is what you want us to do. You know, it's that we already have a legal basis, we have a piece of legislation, we can just do it, put pressure, talk about it, talk to your members of parliament, bring this topic up very regularly. This is a business model of a few companies, and we can change that very, very easily. It's not God-given, it's not nature. We can change it, and this is the right moment to do it. And on an individual level, when we have alternative platforms, like for example, Mastodon and Blue Sky for X, go to them, use them, or Ecosia instead of Google. There's more coming up, and as soon as these alternative platforms come up, there's some European version of Blue Sky coming. Support them just simply by using their services.
Thank you so much. Thank you all. Put all the links you gave me and sent me in different directions, put them all in the chat. I was going to send them with a follow-up email tomorrow or the day after with the recordings, because that's the end. It was really exciting. It was an excellent discussion. Thank you all for so many questions. We're going to keep that. You know, I think there was a third webinar kind of on this area in or just half a year. So we're going to keep on. We're going to keep the pressure. Thanks to all of you. Thanks to all of you in the audience. And this was the last Europe Calling webinar before the summer. So we're going into the summer break if nothing major happens, like, okay, it happens all the time, but I hope it will be a summer break at some point. And then we'll see each other again, probably in August, end of August, with our next installment of Europe Calling. Thank you all very much. Thank you very much to the interpreters as well for your excellent job, and have you all a very nice evening, and best of luck and safety for all of you. Bye-bye.